Hi, this is Mimi, and welcome to my podcast, The Lovely Becoming. Today's guest is Amanda White, who's a therapist located in the Philadelphia area, and I'm so excited to have her on. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Mimi.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled. I've been waiting for this interview for a little while, so jumping right in, tell us about yourself. What do you do? What do you love?
Yeah, I am a therapist. As you said, I'm located in Philadelphia. So in my clinical work, I specialize in eating disorders and substance use. And I also have a private practice in Philadelphia called Therapy for Women. So our brick and mortar location is in Philly, but we also have therapists around the country. And I'm also on Instagram. My handle is Therapy for Women there.
Awesome. Amanda and I connected through Instagram, as with just about everybody. She's one of the therapists I really look up to when thinking about my own future work with clients. And I'm just really grateful for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to be here and chat with you.
Yay. So tell us about your journey to becoming a therapist.
Yes, yes. So it's funny. I feel like I lose track of years these days. So I was not someone who grew up being like, I definitely want to be a therapist. I didn't necessarily know. I was on like a med school track for a little bit where I thought I might want to be a doctor. And I really struggled with the med school track in college. I also struggled with an eating disorder and substance use, specifically alcohol, in college, which really impacted my grades. It impacted just like my friendships with people and stuff like that. And I honestly had a really hard time just like making it through and graduating college. So by the time I was kind of at the end of college, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I was really afraid of getting a job. Like the idea of getting a job terrified me. And my major in college was very strange. It was where I went to school. I went to University of Richmond, and they had a program where you could like create your own major. So I had my major be medical humanities, which was kind of all the, they had a medical humanities minor. It was kind of all these classes that taught you like the social side of medicine. So it was kind of like history of medicine and, you know, psychology classes and anthropology and, you know, social work classes and stuff like that. So I had thought maybe I literally was just like, I need to go to grad school so that I cannot get a job, because I was terrified of getting a job. And I was with my dad watching, I've always loved psychological thrillers, books and movies. And I was like a couple months away from graduating, and I was watching more psychological thrillers with my dad and was struggling with what I wanted to do when I graduated. And my dad was like, you really love psychology, or at least you really love these types of movies. Like, why don't you look into psychology? And I had been in therapy my whole life, struggling. So for a while, the idea of being a therapist or anything like that sounded pretty terrible to me, because I didn't like therapy and I didn't have a great experience with it. But I applied, and I did it really part-time in the beginning just to see if I liked it. And I was really lucky that I found a therapist after graduating who was amazing and who shared about her own struggles. And I really just felt like this is what I want to do. So I was lucky that I was able to get into recovery and also do grad school. And I graduated and went on to work at a treatment facility for substance use. And then I opened my private practice after getting my license.
Wow, I love that. I think it's really hard to know what you want to do. And I had a similar major that was interdisciplinary and kind of made up. But I really remember mine was called Medicine, Health, and Society.
That's pretty similar. I don't know anyone who's had a similar one to me like that. That's pretty similar.
Yeah, we had psychology classes and stuff like that. And so it was a good mesh, but it wasn't like med school type of thing, which is nice.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I love that. Thank you for sharing so so eloquently about your story. Kind of touching on that, what does sobriety mean to you?
Yeah. So for me, I mean, my journey to getting sober was not as straightforward as like my journey to getting into eating disorder recovery. It wasn't a secret in my family or to myself that I had an eating disorder. I had one since I was like 15. The roots took shape before then. I was a competitive figure skater growing up. So there was a huge component of weight and how you looked and performance. And there was a lot of fear, you know, about, you know, developing and growing up. And you used to hear stories about this girl was such a great skater and then she gained weight or she went through puberty and then she wasn't, you know, able to perform the same way. So that was always something that I knew I needed help with. I saw a therapist, but my alcohol addiction didn't look that obvious to me. It was more tied in with my eating disorder. It was that I was afraid of gaining the freshman 15 when I went to college. So I would try to starve myself before I drank, you know, to save the calories for drinking. I would, I started doing a lot of Adderall because I liked how that impacted getting rid of my appetite, things like that. So it wasn't until I was actually in grad school that I really realized that my drinking was really not working. And I kind of was just really lucky that I was in group therapy with other people who I was there for my eating disorder and they were there for sobriety. And I was able to recognize that if I kept going the way I was going, if I kept drinking like this, I wouldn't be able to be a therapist. So I was lucky that I kind of saw a path and was able to take it. So for me, sobriety means I don't drink alcohol anymore. I don't do drugs. And it's really about like facing your life honestly.
What was that process like for you in terms of, and to the extent that you want to answer this question,
Yeah. Thinking
about AA and thinking about different models of sobriety?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that I think is unique for everyone. And I think it's not always a one size fits all thing. For me, I was lucky that I discovered a program called Anorexics and Bulimics Anonymous when I was getting into recovery. And that program was a 12-step program, but unlike Overeaters Anonymous or other food 12-step programs, they were very clear that it wasn't about the food. It was about you, like they would say in the program that we're not addicted to food. We're addicted to trying to control our food, body weight, and shape. So, I mean, it's so interesting now because with like health at every size and everything that I do, like that's completely in alignment with it. And it's interesting that I was lucky that I was able to have that as, I mean, I had dips along the way of, I tried OA and other programs and stuff like that, that didn't work getting into recovery. But I share that because I did have success with that program. And then it wasn't that big of a jump for me to go to AA. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic. I didn't really relate to the idea of being an alcoholic. I much more related to being an addict because I felt the way that my eating disorder showed up was it was bulimia. So it felt in those moments when I was binging or purging or recovering from binging and purging, it felt very like I was a drug addict because it was like the getting of the food, the getting rid of it, the being exhausted, the crash, the high. But I did know that my drinking was a big problem. And AA kind of said that, you know, the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. So that's what I did. And I was lucky, you know, there was just a really strong community of young people in AA in my area, which kept me there. If it weren't for that, I definitely wouldn't have stayed, but I also was lucky that there was a recovery meeting that welcomed all different types of people. So you didn't have to call yourself an alcoholic and things like that. So I was in AA for a few years. You know, I've been sober now for 6.5 years. And I was in AA for at least 4 probably. And eventually it just came to the point for me where a lot of my best friends are still from AA. Some of them are still involved in the program. Some of them aren't. But there are other things that fill me up and nurture my sobriety. I'm not as intimately tied to AA as I used to be. So I think that it can be great for people, but I'm excited also that there are a lot more options, especially with the internet.
Yeah, that's amazing. And thank you for sharing that with us. I think there's a lot of courage that comes with sharing your story, especially as a professional and as a therapist. So I'm curious what that transition was like from graduate school to becoming a professional in the field and what it's like kind of sharing your story through social media.
So it was interesting because I was in recovery from my eating disorder before I got sober. So it's something that now I can say this, like I had moments of, I was in grad school studying addiction counseling, but like looking back, I was like actively in my addiction, but I didn't see it at the time. And there was a lot of, you know, just like denial and things like that. And I had a lot of shame about it for a really, really long time where I felt as though I was a fraud. I felt, you know, like I shouldn't have specialized in addiction because of what I was doing and things like that. But, you know, the more time you have sober, the little bit, you know, I used to not say how many years sober I had for a really long time. Someone once told me, don't ever share how much time you have until you have 5 years sober. And I like stuck to that for a while until I had 5 years. And then I started talking about it. But yeah, so that's been interesting. With that, I mean, I now am like far enough removed from it that I have compassion for myself. And I know that I was doing the best that I could. And I think it's an important thing to talk about because I do think that therapists are humans and therapists struggle. And there is this taboo that if you struggle, you shouldn't be a therapist or you shouldn't specialize in the thing. And I think even just, you know, therapists can judge each other about how healed each other is and things like that. So I'm grateful that Instagram did. I wasn't really on Instagram at that time, so I wasn't sharing my story or anything in that way. But yeah, I mean, like for me now, it's not hard to share my story because I'm far enough removed from it. And I think that it's especially now with the fact that a lot of my day-to-day job isn't always necessarily seeing clients. I still do that, but a lot of my work is supporting the other therapists in my practice. A lot of my work is, you know, I'm writing a book or, you know, business development and training and supervising and stuff like that. So it's a little bit easier to feel like if someone wants to judge me for being honest, that's okay. So I think the more time you have, the easier it kind of gets, but it's definitely been something that, I'm just really passionate about, and I knew was okay to talk about because I mean, I've disclosed that I've been in recovery since I started my private practice. I wrote it on the first website that I ever had. Because for me, when I was getting into recovery and I was finding that therapist after I graduated from college, that was what drew me to that therapist. She had it on her website. So I've really always been of the mindset that the right client will connect with that. And a client that is turned off by that, that's okay. I'm not the right therapist for them.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of goodness that comes from understanding that we're not the right fit for everyone. And that's okay.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So thinking about your private practice, What kind of inspired you to start that? I know we've touched on it a little bit, but for people who are looking to get into private practice, what can you offer to them?
Great question, Mimi. So so I started my practice 3.5, almost 4 years ago. And I was working at a rehab at the time. And I really loved the job, actually. And I was really lucky that I got to work for a while in their long-term women's facility. So I got to work with people for a minimum of 90 days and kind of walk them through the journey of, you know, what it looks like to kind of become sober long-term. And a lot of them ended up with either having eating disorders or recognizing that they had eating disorders earlier that were undiagnosed. So I did a lot of work with people on body image and trauma and the other things that come up. So I loved that work. And the organization changed a bit when I was there. So after I got my license, it just kind of became a natural step for me that I had always wanted a private practice. I had always wanted my own thing. So I just kind of took a shot and I found a, you know, office space that I thought was cute. And I just kind of went for it and didn't know what I was doing like at all really, but was just like, I'm going to try this out and see. And, you know, I loved it. And I really loved the work I was doing. I got lonely pretty quickly. So within, after about a year, I hired one of my friends to come work with me, and it just kind of kept expanding from there. So it's very interesting looking back, because never in my wildest dreams would I imagine that this would be where it would be. I always thought maybe I would have one person work for me, you know, maybe two, but I never expected this, which is amazing, but weird when you look back on it. So yeah, hopefully that answers the question.
Yes. Sometimes I forget the questions, and honestly, I don't even remember what I asked, but I loved it. I'm curious what you think of the term codependency, especially in relation to attachment styles and our need for one another, because that term gets thrown around pretty negatively sometimes. So I'm curious.
Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting. My perspective has changed a lot since I've seen it on social media so much. And because I think that term was, like, I used to use the term and work a lot more with that when I worked primarily with people with substance use disorders, because I think people forget the term was actually created in that blanket of substance use disorders. It was created with the idea of, family members can become, like, you know, they can become codependent with other people, with, you know, especially people that are using substances, and they get their fulfillment out of the other person and things like that. And I think it's really important to remember that we are, you know, human beings are wired for connection. Like, we really neurobiologically need each other. And there's nothing wrong with being needy or needing someone. I used to, when I was like single and much younger, used to really feel like I need to be alone and I need to prove that I can be by myself. And while there was like good that came out of that, I think I also did shame myself a lot for wanting connection. And, I think that that unfortunately does happen on social media, and it can be hard to watch, because I think on some levels, especially when we're talking about someone's pattern, if they, you know, have things going on where they're making choices that they don't feel good about, where they're going back to relationships that don't serve them, or they're staying in relationships that don't serve them, there may be some codependency things going on. But I think the context matters so, so much. And I personally don't talk about codependency on my page really at all, because I think it's so nuanced. I think it matters so much who's reading that, and I can't guarantee who's reading it. So it's not something that I talk a lot about because I think it's just a complicated concept that can be just pathologized and people feel bad for needing connection. And a lot of times there's nothing wrong with that.
I appreciate that perspective a lot because I think there's a lot of both bashing of codependency and also like glorifying of it. So there's a lot of a space for that as well.
Yeah, I think with most things, the middle is where we need to be. Because I have worked with clients, you know, when I have worked with clients who have really used, especially those who have struggled with alcohol or eating disorders, like they have used relationships to deal with their emotions or to work through something or to, you know, change how they're feeling or to get a sense of feeling better about themselves or whatever. Or I've worked with parents who really are exhibiting codependent behaviors with their child, thinking they can, you know, save their child or fix their child or fix their partner. But I'm just not a fan of labels. When I see labels, I don't love it. I prefer using codependent behaviors rather than the word you are a codependent. Just because I believe in, you know, person-centered language is the most destigmatizing thing that we can do.
Absolutely, yes. Tell us a little bit about boundaries, especially with diet talk or with like people offering you a drink, things like that.
Yeah, I think boundaries are something that are so important, and I'm so glad that there are more and more conversations about them on social media, in our culture. I mean, if you're going to be someone who gets into recovery from an eating disorder or substance use or anything, even if you just want to improve your mental health, boundaries are going to be a really big component of that. And most of us grew up in a house just based on when the term boundaries existed and was created. Most of us grew up in a house where our parents didn't know that concept. They didn't understand it. It wasn't their fault. I think it's an important thing. Sometimes I try to remember, you know, the field of counseling in general wasn't created until like 1950. Like, it's really not old. So most of our parents were born, you know, around there, after, you know, a couple decades after there, where they wouldn't have grown up really knowing this, which I think is part of why millennials and then Gen X is like become kind of the therapy generation. So I say all that because I think most of us don't grow up with boundaries. We don't understand what they are. And they're really, really important. And they're something that we often have to learn later in life because they weren't modeled to us. So it can feel awkward and uncomfortable, but especially with, like you were talking about, with diet talk and stuff like that, especially when you do something that's different than the norm, like not engaging in diet culture is against the norm. Not drinking is against the norm. Setting those boundaries for yourself, telling people that you're not going to engage in this kind of discussion, or you're not interested in a drink, or you don't want to hear about their diet, or please don't comment on my weight. They're so important for your sanity. And it's a way you honor yourself. It's a way you say, like, I deserve to, you know, it's like the ultimate form of self-care, I think.
Absolutely. I was thinking about like what even are boundaries the other day, and it's hard to define and explain, but they are so crucial to our day-to-day lives and relationships.
Yeah. Some people describe them as a limit and a consequence. And I don't, like, I get that understanding, but I am personally, maybe it's because I'm like complicated and think everything is nuanced, but I don't love the idea that about, like, I don't love the idea of the concept that it's like, you know, no is a complete sentence and all of that stuff. While I understand where it comes from and I think it can have value, I think that a lot of times boundaries are like messy and complicated. And yeah, you could just say no to everyone if you wanted to, but a lot of boundaries in real life to me are actually conversations. And I think sometimes people simplify them into saying a boundary is just saying no and saying, if you do this again, I'm going to do that. And to me, boundaries are like, I really am a big believer in boundary negotiation, where we're always in this conversation of resetting. I mean, most of what a boundary is upholding it. It's resetting the boundary. It's reexamining whether that boundary is still working for you and it needs to be changed. It's saying and having those conversations of kind of like, you know, hey, when you say this, I feel this way, you know, I know you don't mean that, but this is the way it is for me. And I care about you. I love you. And if you keep talking about your diet, I'm not going to be able to spend as much time with you. It's that whole conversation, which lands very differently than just saying, don't talk about your diet, or I'm not going to talk to you anymore. Cause that can leave people a little, you know, jarred sometimes.
Yes, that makes sense. And I think I'm even learning right now in this moment, that it's not really like a static, like this is it and it never changes. Like there's a lot more that goes into it.
Yeah. And I think that helps change the expectations of them. Cause if we have it that it's just like, I set boundaries and I set them once and then I'm good, I think we're setting ourselves and others up for disappointment when things change, or we change, or people forget, you know, like sometimes people forget our boundaries and we have to reinstate them, or our lives change and then we need different boundaries. And I think so many of us can feel, and I used to feel this way a lot, like I can't wait until I'm like fixed and I'm done and I can just like stop working on myself. And it's like, there will always be something to probably work on. So let's just change our mindset to like, how do we maintain these things versus like set and forget?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I read something the other day that was like, you don't always have to be healing and working on yourself 24/7. And I love that. Like we can just be and keep working on maintaining our boundaries. Yeah.
Yeah. And go through phases where maybe we're, you know, maybe we're working on resting. That's something that we probably all need to work on.
Yes. Oh, goodness. What does self-care look like for you in your day-to-day life?
Self-care for me looks like sometimes not changing out of my pajamas until like late at night. Like it is the last thing that I care about, honestly, these days is like how I look. So it's just like, if it's not needed, like I'm not doing it. It's a waste of energy right now. I feel like in the pandemic. It's sleeping. I have always kind of been a troubled sleeper. I struggle to sleep. So I really have to prioritize sleeping. It looks like movement. Movement for me is so important. It's super key with sleeping also. I sleep so much better if I move my body in some capacity every day. I also love to stretch. So I just will like sit on the floor and just like stretch in random ways. I guess it's still like the figure skater in me that like used to stretch for so long, but it's like feeling good. Like to me, a big key of it, I think, is reconnecting with my body. Cause I've always been someone with skating that has felt like I've processed emotions through my body. And I think another thing that I've really like reclaimed is like, I have a right to feel like pleasure and feel good in my body, whether it's taking a shower, whether it's stretching, whether it's, you know, getting a massage or giving myself a massage. Like I deserve that too.
Awesome. I love the stretching one. Oh goodness. What are your favorite foods?
I have a huge sweet tooth. And it's so great that I don't have to worry about that anymore. And I don't, oh my God, the amount of time and energy I spent demonizing myself over it. So yeah, I have dessert every day, pretty much. I love ice cream. I love avocados and guacamole and Mexican food. I love hot sauce. I also love cereal, pizza, all the things. But I also like love a really good salad. Like I really like when I'm struggling to just like get food in my body and I know that I need more nourishment, I love Sweet Green. Do you guys have them by you?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Like I love their like rice and sweet green, like their rice bowls with kale. And that's just something that like when I'm being lazy and I need to take care of myself and I don't want to cook, that's like a comfort meal for me for sure.
Yes. Salads are so good, especially with like grains in them and stuff.
So wow. Hearty. Yeah.
Yes.
I love texture. So I like love all like the different textures that go into like one thing.
Yes. And I love being able to pick like what you want. Like at home, I feel like there's not enough topping.
Yeah. I know. I like at home, my salads are like lettuce and carrots and like dressing.
And the chopping process is kind of hard at home too.
Yeah, definitely.
My last question is when I ask all my listeners, I guess, oh gosh. But I'm wondering, how are you becoming?
Oh, I love that. I am becoming someone who slows down more, which is good. I mean, I think it's interesting in the pandemic because I just feel like I can tell that I've changed a lot, but I can't tell yet how, you know, like, because I can't tell what is me surviving right now and what will be there when things slightly open up or slightly return to normal a little bit. So I feel like a big part of this year has just been like riding the wave, letting myself just like, I mean, I've literally this year have been like, I'm going to move here. I'm going to move here. I want this. I want that. I like, I had this whole thing this year where I was like, I need to move to a farm and like live on a farm. And my parents were like, that's not you. You're crazy. But it's just been like, I don't know. Cause I'm in the city right now and it's hard being in a city in the pandemic and stuff like that. And so I just feel like I'm figuring things out. That's kind of where I am. And I'm really like practicing non-attachment to my thoughts, my emotions, my feelings, and using values as my guiding point to taking action.
That is so good. I love that. Thank you so much for coming on today. I love everything you do.
You're so great, Mimi. I love all of your work too. So it was very fun to just chat with you.
Yay.